You're listening to Buildipedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Buildipedia. And today, something really different. Someone who's connected to the building industry, but not technically part of the building industry, although making a contribution. Joining us today, Weibo Patel, director of Aussies Group. He's a registered migration agent. And we know him because he helped one of our staff become an Australian citizen, get residency. So, Weibo, thank you. And thanks for coming in today. And thanks for agreeing to join us on Buildipedia.
Thank you very much, Matt, for inviting me in this podcast. And I'm really excited to be part of it, and looking forward to have some fruitful conversations that can help us as well as the people who are listening to this podcast.
Yeah, because it has been quite a hot topic. And what I really want to explore today is the connection between immigration law and the ability of someone in a suburb somewhere in Sydney to get some work done on their house, and how hard it is, and how the quality of the workers and the availability of skilled people is connected intimately to migration and migration law as a connection. But before we start, we always ask our guests to share something or an inspiration. And so, yeah, we're going to ask Weibo if you've got a inspiration.
Yes, actually, I like reading books. So I've recently started a book called Start With Why, which is written by Simon Sinek. I have really busy schedule, but generally I spend some time every day to at least read 2 to 3 pages to ensure that I read that and use that throughout my day. And I was really impressed with the stories, and especially the example of the Wright brothers that they used in the book, where, how having the lot of infrastructure as well as all the resources to build something, but without the will, you can't really reach there. And on the other hand, someone who did not really have a lot of good resources could easily achieve that target just because they had a right will to do it. So the Wright brothers are the example, and I think a lot of people might not know this. So there was another person called Langley. I don't remember the full name, but he had a lot of support from the government, and he was working also on building the planes, have a first human flight. And at the same time, Wright brothers were also trying that. And Wright brothers didn't really have a lot of resources, not skilled people, not really qualified engineers or who has done research and everything. On the other hand, Langley had a lot of resources in terms of money as well, no monetary restrictions in terms of budgets, and had a lot of people who he could hire, and he had hired, to help him build the plane. But the thing is, at the end, who won is someone who really had a motivation to fight through the setbacks and failures and to innovate and collaborate in order to achieve their goal. So that's the story that inspired me a lot. And I relate this to my work as well, because as on a day-to-day basis, I meet the clients who wants to move to Australia. They're passionate about building their life here. And again, it takes a reason or a why to pursue the pathway to build your life in Australia. Right? So passion and the cause inspires me to find the solution for my clients. And it really makes my day when I see the clients making their Australian dream come true. And I'm glad that I was a part of their journey, and especially, like, let's say, one of your employees, right? So I was part of his journey. And I think the respect that we get in return is immense. The way they look at us is completely different than, you see the thank you forever in their eyes when they speak to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same when you sponsor them, the level of loyalty and the relationship is different. It's not like any other employee. It's very much a family. It's a different sort of thing. And it's funny that you should bring up the book Starting With Why. I mean, I have listened to it. It's been a while since I listened to it. I only listen to audiobooks. I don't have the focus to read, but I love to listen to audiobooks when I'm walking or riding my bike, or yeah, but I think I can relate to the business idea of starting with why, because that is the first question I ask my clients. Because they start by going, you know, clients tend to bring you into their house and say, oh, I want a bigger kitchen, I want a bathroom. And the first question I say is, why are you doing this? What is the purpose? Why are we here? Why am I talking to you? And that's the most important question you can ever ask your client. And it's very powerful and it changes the nature of the conversation. But it is very important, like, it's not just a sales technique. It's very important that you know why they're doing it, because then you can help create a solution. If you don't know why they're doing it, how can you be part of a solution? So yeah, we always go in because clients bring us in. They want work done on their house, but why they're doing it totally changes the conversation quickly. Because if they're doing it for a quick turnaround, if they're trying to flip it quickly, it's a different thing. It's a very different approach. If they're doing it for themselves because that's the house of their dreams that they're going to live in, well, again, it's a different thing. So you give them different advice. You make for every client, and it's the same for you. You know that you have to make decisions on their behalf at some point. You can't involve a client in the micro workings. But if you've got that purpose, then you can focus on that purpose, and that way they're happy, but you're not having to ask them every last detail. But I guess in your case, the purpose is clear. People generally want to move here and live here and have a better life, I presume. But is that a fair assumption?
Yes. I think everyone has their different reasons. Some are looking for a better lifestyle, or some are looking for better economic conditions. But yes, overall, it's all related to their building their life in Australia and having a better quality of life overall. For them, there's kids. Some also have a lot of money in their own country, but they still want to move to Australia. The reason is because they want to feel secured in terms of the government's approach. Like, for example, let's say if you see currently that a lot of countries under war, right? So they wouldn't really want to be there because they don't see a future for their kids, because they don't really have any certainty about their future. And they live in that uncertainty. So even if you have a lot of money, but you're in, let's say, a country like which is already in war zone, you want to probably move out and go to somewhere secured for your kids. So I think people are trying to move to Australia on different reasons. Individual people have individual reasons for them. But overall, it's all related to their better quality of life. And Australia being pretty much not attached to any country geographically, so it makes it unique and has a lot of opportunity already. So, and because we need a migrant population to meet our population, you know, objectives, so the government is still, you know, focused on meeting their population targets for each 5 years. So, and I think the only way we can quickly approach is using the migration as the to increase the population in Australia, and with that it brings a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. But I was going to ask you if it's okay, like, tell us about your migration journey and tell us how you came to be in Australia and where your family came from.
Oh yeah, I'm a migrant myself. I came to Australia to study in 2008, and I was just 18 at that time. So I was very passionate about IT, and obviously being Indian background, you know, I think it's in our blood, I guess, that we want to really study IT. And then I was good with computers. And one fine day, my friend started his journey as a migration agent. He was also an engineer. He chose to leave everything and then work in this industry, you know. And then I started with him to just help him out for initially, and with no intention to be here because my passion was IT. And then eventually, when I spent time in this industry, I started loving it, you know, the law part of it, reading the law, finding solutions for the client, especially the complex ones, you know. We have seen cases where people have just taken their hands off, and we would still say, yes, okay, let us try. We would be honest with our advice and tell them that, yes, there is a risk, but we would try every possible way to help you out. And then throughout that journey, you know, we found a lot of solutions for our clients where people just could not really think out of the box. And that inspired me to to continue to work in this industry. And then, you know, eventually I became a migration agent and then started my journey. And I was 25 when I moved to Sydney and started my own business here in Sydney.
Yeah, right. So you're, I guess, from that wave, because my parents and I was born in Poland. My parents came here as partly economic, partly political refugees, but it was a different era. It was the early 80s and the government paid for us to come here. It was a different time and different world, I guess.
Yeah, some would say.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, but yeah, that's a different route for migration. That was the typical route for migration. People were sponsored, people found asylum. Most people came, they were skilled in somewhat, maybe they couldn't work in the things they were skilled in their home country, but it seems like that's changed a lot. And most immigrants now, and I'm wondering what portion of immigrants to Australia now are student, people who come on a student visa and decide to stay. Like, has that statistic flipped? Has that changed from 30 years ago, 40 years ago to now?
Yes. You know, if you see, like, even 20 years ago, I would say the number of students coming to Australia were not that high. And then after 2005, I think the number of students increased because, see, the migration policy before 2005 was quite easy. People could easily migrate to Australia. And before 2000, it was even easy. You know, so I think after that, the migration policy became stricter and stricter as the time passed. So the only way the students or international people saw is to come in as a student, study here, gain some skills. And obviously, Australian education system is one of the best ones in the world. So that also attracts people because if you see, we have in top 100 universities, we have a good number of universities from Australia. So that also attracts students to come to Australia to study. That offers lifestyle along with the study, offers opportunity to work in their area of interest. You know, so a lot of good things about studying in Australia. So I think that attracts more students now than ever before.
Yeah. And we're going to get to questions about, you know, skill shortages and things like that. But I'm wondering how, you know, just that fact alone, that if you're an immigrant to Australia, let's say, you're much more likely to be a student today than you would have been even 20 years ago, and how that fact alone is changing the fabric of Australia, because it's all about training. We're a training facility almost. Australia is one big training college, so to speak.
But if you see, I think Australia's education industry is in billion. So it's one of our export, as you can call it an export, because it's an export of services, of education services, right? So it's one of the biggest industry in Australia right now. And I see it as a good side of it, because see, if you see previously, people were trained overseas and they used to come here and then work here, right? So they were not trained in Australia. So they were not trained according to Australian standards. But now that the students come here to study, they get trained here and then they go into the job market. Obviously, they would have better skills because they were trained in Australia according to the Australian standards. So when they get into the job market, if you see, those people would have better skills than if you bring someone from overseas who did not really have an exposure to Australian training or did not really have an exposure to Australian way of working.
I guess I'm curious as to what effect that has, because I take your point. We've got world-class training facilities. You know, there's world-class research opportunities. But I wonder, are we not then creating a monoculture of training? Is there not value in bringing people that have been trained in different parts of the world to bring different ideas? So my concern is that we're not exchanging skills. We're not bringing in enough skilled people. We're just training the trainers and the trainer, you know, we're creating an internal loop, essentially. So I wonder how much that is good, because what I know, the thing that I know And something that's reasonably accepted as proven, as I guess with good evidence behind it, is that diversity is strength. So if you have a diverse group of people, it's a stronger group, right? Whether that's a management team, whether it's just a random group of people who are thrown together to solve a problem. What I know from well-established in many papers, in many science papers, is a diverse group solves problems, gets better results than a group who all agree and who all are very similar. So I wonder if you expand that on a country level, whether we're becoming a very uniform group because we're all coming through the same training centers who are using very similar methodologies, similar systems, whether that lack of diversity is hurting us.
I think it's basically what happens is Australia has got different pathways, right? So it's one pathway that students would come here, get trained and work in the workforce. The second pathway is generally, you know, a lot of employers that we work with, we use that pathway because they're not able to find a skilled workers within Australia. And obviously you can't just train people overnight and they become a good workforce. So there are different programs that the government is running under the migration program, which is student visa, the skill visa. Now, skill visa is also open to people who are in Australia, either on a student visa or any other temporary visa, right? Like we did for your one of your employees. Or you could also bring skilled workers from overseas, right? So the government runs, let's say, a skill visa programs. Then they have an employer-sponsored visa programs where the companies can utilize 482 visas or 186 visas or 494 visas to bring people to work from overseas who are completely trained overseas. And they have sufficient number of years of experience. So they're at least, you know, we are sure that this person who's coming to Australia to work in this particular occupation is skilled for that particular occupation. Then the government runs another program called Global Talent, which is focusing on completely exceptional talented people from around the world. So they bring people from, like, let's say, research backgrounds, someone really expert in academia, someone really expert in fintech, digitech, you know, so they have different programs. So it's, the government doesn't really work on just one particular program. They work in a diverse program so that, as you said, that we really need a diverse community. And with these different programs, we can have, you know, different skilled workers coming in through using the different pathways. Some would get trained in Australia, but some would have been already trained overseas and would have worked for certain years, and they would bring their skills here and then exchange that with their teammates when they work here.
I guess the point I was making is because, sure, there is diversity, but there's a degree of diversity. And it feels like when most, yeah, of course, there's always people naturally coming in, visiting, working remotely with people who are overseas. But I still think, like, if you have a large proportion trained internally, does that impact? And it may not be the way I'm describing, but I'm just wondering how it changes our society to have, yeah, a lot of students coming and staying, and that, how it, okay, maybe it's not the way I described, but yeah, what is the impact that we're not even thinking of right now? You know, we're bringing in young people. And also, this might be my misguided view, but I think a lot of students that are coming, they're not from poor backgrounds. They're primarily middle class, right? Is that a fair assumption?
Fair guess. Majority of the students who come here, generally they get, anyways, there is a criteria called financial ability to support yourself while you're studying in Australia. So they are actually go through that particular check to ensure that they can come here and afford to study. So yes, your assumption is quite fair that the most of the people who come here to study are from, you know, at least middle class. And in terms of, as you said, you know, yes, your concern about using students pathway only and that relying on that majorly creating a bit of imbalance, that's where you're coming from, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a problem or if it's like, I'm not saying, hey, this is a big problem. The curiosity is how it changes our society, how it skews or how it moves the needle on what our society is. So it's not that it's a problem. It's not a problem that the middle class or students, I mean, that's not, it's yeah.
No, I understand. What you're saying is the imbalance of, you know, bringing directly skilled worker who have already worked overseas and over the number of students coming to Australia. So yes, but if you see, I think most likely we're expecting a major reform coming in the migration policies early next year. And if you see, there has been an announcement just a couple of days ago that the government is expanding the permanent pathways for overseas workers who are on a TSS visa, which is subclass 42, which is generally sponsored by company. So to address, you know, the skill shortages, especially, let's say, construction industry, I think if you see around more than, I guess, from the statistics, I remember that there was huge shortages of the skilled workers in Australia. And that probably is somewhere around hundreds of thousands, you know, so let's say around 500,000 or so.
I think the key question, I wanted to put a scenario to you. This is the key question that I had. And yes, the skill shortage has been absolutely brutal. It's killed businesses. There's no doubt about it. It's killed building companies. It's destroyed livelihoods. The skill shortage has been incredibly terrible, like for a lot of people. And skill shortages drive up prices. They don't just drive up the price of a tradesman or a bricklayer. They drive up supply prices because wherever you need, particularly things, we've seen things where labor is a key component, like custom flashings, custom production items. Wherever we've seen that, prices have spiked and literally destroyed businesses. And the one that really stick, and it's one of those mysteries, and I still don't know why or how, but bricklayers just disappeared from the world. like a year and a half ago, where were the bricklayers? I don't know what happened to them all. They were all abducted by aliens, or they were, I have a theory that they were building some grand underground subway station that we're going to discover one day. And I haven't looked into it, but I get a bit of a sense that I'm going to like get an escalator down into a subway. And I'm going to see a billion bricks that have been laid, and I'll be like, that's where the bricklayers were. Or I'm going to drive through one of the tunnels that are about to open, and I'm going to go, aha, that's where the bricks were laid when we couldn't get brickies. So here's my observation. Couldn't get bricklayers. Just had to wait for 2 months to get bricklayers. We had this, particularly for one of our clients, we were waiting for bricklayers. I mean, we couldn't have bricks sitting on site, but finally we had the bricklayers coming in 2 weeks. Then the bricks were flooded in Victoria. There was floods in Victoria. So we had the bricklayers lined up. We couldn't get the bricks. And it was an awful time to be a builder. It was, and I don't know, like it's almost burned into my memory, but 2022, it rained all year, couldn't get anyone to work, couldn't get anything done. Materials were coming in and out of supply. It was just a brutal year. And it was probably one of the hardest years I know in business. But the real killer, the weather we could work around, supply chains we could work around, you know, there was always a way, but skill shortage, that was what killed businesses.
The Australian labor market, just in construction industry, you're likely to have around 540,000 or 50,000 skill shortages just in construction industry. So occupations that relates to construction industry, like painters, tilers, plumbers, carpenters, you know. So look, that's where the employer sponsorship visas comes in. And I believe that a lot of companies or a lot of employers who are working in, let's say, you know, providing services related to construction, they don't probably have that available information on them that they could utilize pathways like this, which is the TSS visa, to work, to bring the overseas worker to work for them. Like, let's say, as you said, you know, you were facing skill shortages in particular occupation. You could have used the employer sponsorship pathways. The only thing is, right now, as of today, the cost associated with bringing someone from overseas is quite high, to my opinion. It used to be a bit comparatively lower than this before, almost half of it, I would say. But nowadays, the cost increased by the government in this particular visa section is quite high. And, you know, it's both ends. Yes, we understand that the government really needs to charge this money so that they can use this fund to train Australian citizens to become skilled in this particular occupation. But at the same time, if you see as an employer, it's a huge cost to you, you know. And what if you bring an employee? You know, there are worries in employers' end as well that I'm going to invest this much, that's fine, this person going to work for me for 4 years. Good, in all good case scenarios, all good. But in a case where, let's say, the employee doesn't turn to be a good employee, then you have invested the money on the wrong person. So that's where you like
to be. A big call, isn't it? Yeah, it's a big risk.
Yes. But at the same time, it's rewarding. So if you see, if you utilize these pathways, and we have a lot of clients who have been utilizing the sponsorship pathways to bring overseas worker to work for them. The reason is because they are employed on your, so generally in construction industry, it's all subcontracted. But to bring someone to work for you on the TSS visa, you have to employ them as their, as your employee. That means they're available full time just for your own projects, right? So as long as you have enough work on your plate, it is affordable and it is rewarding for your business as well to employ someone full time in, let's say, for example, as a bricklayer. If you have enough work for them to continue work for 4 years, then yes, you know, sponsoring them would be a good idea and good pathway, because you're not able to find a good skilled worker from local labor market. You can advertise your position and look for the skilled workers anywhere around the world, and you simply you know, use this pathway where you can simply bring them to work for you for up to 4 years. And good thing about this is that you can also then later on decide as an employer whether you want this person to work for you on a permanent basis or not. If you really like them, they're really a good worker, you can go to the next step, helping them settle in Australia on a permanent basis. And that way you get a good long-term employee, as well as, you know, you're addressing your skill shortages in your business. And, you know, everybody's happy. The person gets a good quality of life here in Australia, right? So everybody wins in this situation.
Yeah. So as a small business, what makes it, apart from the cost, recruiting overseas is really out of reach. It's a different level of expertise. So I would say probably suitable for bigger companies, unless you have a personal referral, unless someone personally says, this person, I know this person, they're amazing. Which brings me to the next question or the next, because, okay, we had a skills shortage. We couldn't find a bricklayer. It was hard to get tilers. It was hard, like it was just tough. So Malik, who we sponsored, we sponsored Malik, and Malik brought his family. He's now an Australian citizen, and he's originally from Pakistan. And I have to say, like, yeah, he's definitely part of the family, definitely part of our company fabric. But he had a solution, right? And he said, yeah, I know people, because he went to Pakistan to visit his mum, still lives in Pakistan. He's got family there, obviously. And he said, I've got really great tradesmen. There's really great tradesmen. There's great stonemasons, tilers. They're excellent, amazingly skilled people, and they want to come to Australia. There was just one problem, unless we missed something or unless we didn't think of something, but there was one problem that's an amazing, experienced, very skilled tradespeople, which we could not get in Australia, but there was one reason that we could not get them here, and you probably know what that is.
English.
Yeah, English. And I think that's the conundrum for skills, people with hand skills, people who go and develop hand skills, who are tradesmen don't develop English skills, or they tend not to be studious. And it's the same here. And I think, and the comment I make is our Irish carpenters that we have working in Australia, I don't think they would pass the English test either. But I mean, that's the key question. So I'd really want to know more about what is this English test, how it applies. So if there's a skilled craftsman in Pakistan and I want to bring them to Australia, what do they have to do? And okay, say they're a bricklayer, we're definitely short of bricklayers. Why is there a barrier, and what is the barrier?
I completely, you know, I have that in my head as well, that sometimes, you know, if you rightly said that, I can't agree more, that if some of Australian trades worker went to an English test as well, they would probably not have passed the same thing as well. It's just that they speak good English because it's their mother tongue. But apart from that, if they went for a grammatical exam, or if they went to do a writing test, they would probably not do well as well, because they're not good at spelling, or they're not good at grammar, or one or the other way. So yes, I agree that. But the only thing, I think the English requirement is there because, yes, you're good with your hands, but then sometimes the instruction will come from you, let's say from Matt. And Matt only speaks English. Matt cannot give instruction in any other language, right? So for this overseas worker to understand the instructions, they will have to have at least a functional English, right? So if you see, therefore, especially the employer sponsorship visa and the one TSS, the 482 surplus, has the lowest English language requirement, which is functional English, which is like you just need 5 bands in IELTS. So the IELTS exam is an English language test, consists of 4 components: reading, writing, listening, and speaking. And each test is conducted in their own formats. So the only thing that they have to show is that they have at least functional English, which is very basic and it's not really tough to pass. But I understand where you're coming from, that, you know, if maybe an Australian tradesperson went for the same exam, probably would score the same as the other person who does not know English, just because that person has a mother tongue as an English, the other one doesn't really have the mother tongue in English, but this person would still fail, but is able to understand instructions coming from that, right? So if you compare it, let's say somebody, an Australian tradesperson and let's example, Pakistani tradesperson. The Australian tradesperson would definitely fail the exam, let's assume, right? This person would also fail the exam from Pakistan. But Australian tradesperson would understand your instruction and do the job that you told, right? Whereas this person, if they don't understand your instructions, they might end up doing something else, right? And sometimes some occupations like carpenter, right? So it's, if the carpenter does something wrong in his job, it might just bring the whole house down.
Hopefully not, but yeah, hopefully someone sees it before that happens. But yeah, I totally understand that. So it's not that the English test is incredibly difficult. It's more so that most stonemasons, carpenters, tilers in India or in Pakistan probably don't even have functional English. Is that a fair assumption, or are we just not talking to the right people?
Not really. Yes, you're right. So because see, over in any of these countries, like, you know, on any South Asian countries, or if you go to, let's say, other countries where they don't speak English, let's say you go to Germany, you go to France, you know, so they're skilled people, but they can't speak English. You know? So they're not good at English.
Oh, I think English is very much, yeah. Not many people in Germany can't speak English. Like, it's very much like built into the school system. So it'd be very rare to find a young German person who cannot converse in English. Like, it's a different, I mean, it's a different standard, and they're part of the, I guess, part of the EU, and one of the languages of the EU is English. So it's a different, yeah, it's a very different world.
Basically, what I was trying to tell you is that, yes, there is definitely, you know, anywhere from the, around the world where English is not used as the main language of communication. Could be, as I said, Indian subcontinent or anywhere in the world where English is not their first language, they might find it difficult, but they're really good skilled workers, you know. So the only thing that probably, and especially, let's say, you know, if I take an example of India or Pakistan, yes, they don't go to study. If they went to study, they would not be working in this skilled work. You know, they might be working in an office environment or maybe in IT or engineers, right? So because they don't speak good English or maybe they were not studious, that's when they chose these other trades where they enjoy working, but they don't really good at studying. So yes, I agree at some point, yes, you have to be flexible for this kind of skilled workers to be able to come to Australia, even though they have a limited English abilities. But yes, as of now, we don't really have very strict English requirements and we don't have very easy English requirements, right? So it's, we sit in between somewhere. So as an Australian immigration policy, you know, so right now the policies are somewhere balanced, but I understand that some visa will have that option. Like, let's say if you find a worker on, you know, that reminds me of another visa surplus. So if you find a worker who can't really speak good English, but maybe has a good skills, you can bring those workers probably on a short-term basis, like let's say using a surplus 400 visa, but that visa is just granted for 6 months. So that person can work, come here and work for you for 6 months, and then they have to go back. Or if they develop a good English in this time, so if they are able to develop, let's say, because they spent 6 months here, they are confident that now my English is at least better than what it was before, then they could probably appear in the English test and see if they can get a better score. And if they meet the requirement, they could also apply for further visas such as 42, where there is an English language requirement. But it's not very high.
Okay, so there is an opportunity to bring skilled people on a six-month visa and train them up in English and then get that visa extended, which I didn't know about. I mean, I just understood that the only option was to pass an English test. I guess when you're asking, it depends on what you ask, because maybe we were asking about bringing in people who can't speak English on a work visa. But yeah, so there's a few options. So you don't, like, if you have someone who's a brilliant tradesman, there are options. You can still bring them.
That's right. So that's when you really need a good migration advice to be able to find the right solution.
Yeah.
That's where we come in, right? So we help the businesses. We've been helping, you know, small to medium businesses to large scale businesses as well in bringing their skilled employees from overseas and helping them make the right choice of visa or visa passes that they can utilize to have their employees come in and work for them. Now, depending on the you know, their requirement as well as the applicants or, you know, their English language skills, etc. So there are a lot of combination that we have to work with and to find out that yes, this is the right visa pathway for your requirement in also in line with the applicant's skills in English and other areas.
And so brings me to the next kind of question or I guess idea. We're spending an incredible amount of money. I reposted about this on LinkedIn the other day, but we're spending billions and billions of dollars on training and skills training, but our kids don't really want to train as tradesmen. They want to be lawyers. They want to be real estate agents. They want to be property developers. So we're spending all this money on training. Should the Australian government, instead of spending billions on training people who maybe don't even want to be trained, and 500,000, is that right? Is that what you said? 500,000 skill shortage, yeah. Just in construction. Yeah. So are we better off setting up English clinics in Pakistan, India, Nepal, anywhere where there's a demand for skilled tradesmen to come? And are we better off bringing people? Because the way I thought about this problem is, think of a tier one employer, okay? Think of Lendlease, think of Atlassian, and they've got a skills shortage that is hurting their business. It's hurting their core business, just like the skills shortage is hurting the Australian economy. What do they do? What's the first thing they do? Do they start a training program? Probably not, right? They're not. They're going to try and fill. Training's incredibly important, but the most important thing is to fill that shortage as quickly as you possibly can. And I think that Australia is spending billions of dollars on bringing people into trades. The training of those people sucks people out of the industry because you have to have qualified, experienced trainers. So that takes skilled people out of the trade system, out of the building industry, ironically sucks skills out and takes those people from the building industry, puts them into the training, into the education industry, right? So that's already a net loss before you've even started. So I'm thinking we need, and it feels a little bit protectionist and it feels a bit odd that whenever governments talk about trade skill shortages, they never say, let's bring people from Pakistan. It's always training. We're always going to train ourselves out of this disaster, 500,000 short of people, tradespeople, you know, which is a disaster for the industry. It's a disaster for housing supply. It's actually something that's debilitating at times. And, you know, construction is cyclical and lumpy. So at different times, different effects. It feels like we're coming out of a real labor crunch. But that all comes in waves. But overall, it feels like we're really short and we're doing the wrong thing by focusing on training. So I'd be curious to know if you think that there's any validity in that. I mean, I put it out there. I don't know if I'm right.
Since it's both sides, but yes, one side is where you're coming from, where I also see that, yes, if as you said, you know, if you're going to train Australians, then you're going to make someone a trainer who would be an expert in that particular area. So they're out of the skilled work. Also, now who you will be training, right? They will be coming out from some other industry. Let's say you want to train people to be a tradespeople, but maybe, you know, the trade people are coming in from some other area, you know, other area. So if you see, if I'm, let's say, we want someone to work in the construction industry and you're pulling this skilled worker out of from, let's say, transport industry. So that means you're just transferring people from transport industry to come and work in the construction industry because they got trained under this training program. Now the transport industry's got a problem. Because now they face the skill shortage because their employees now are being transferred and skilled into other area and they would just end up in another industry because there is more money in that industry.
And then the next layer is like, okay, so we're bringing in lots of people who we can train, but they're middle class kids from middle class parents and they have aspirations that probably exceed being a bricklayer, right? And I like not all of them. Some of them are very keen to do a carpentry apprenticeship. But again, that's with a view to becoming a builder one day, having a business. And those kids want to excel. And because I see it in them and I hear it from talking to them that they have bigger ambitions than to lay tiles, right? So where are the people who are going to keep laying the and you know, we're lucky in that we've got some amazing craftsmen working for us who lay all our tiles. But I think if you're going to the market for a tiler, the quality differential is incredible. The skill levels are incredible. And I wonder if that's, yeah. And I've seen a decline in standards generally. Well, it's anecdotal. I haven't studied it. I haven't got data. I haven't got hard data, but I see, yeah, the level of skill.
It's from your own experience.
Right? Yeah, skill and experience. Yeah, I mean, the two go hand in hand. Without experience, the skill level is much lower always. But I wonder how much of an impact that fixation on always training, being the place that trains people, and gets them qualified, how much of that is impacting the quality of the buildings?
I think it's a time-consuming process because obviously when you have to train people, so as you said, you know, if let's say a big company, like any big company would not really first, they would not just go and train people. They would probably go and hire someone, pay extra money and hire and then get the job done because no time for money and training is a time-consuming process. And sometimes, especially in the government projects of training, a lot of money doesn't really get to the right place because sometimes the training, and we have seen a lot of scams as well, where the training institutions have conducted, you know, someone doesn't really need to be trained. They're not going to work in the industry. They're sitting on a street and not working. And they've just got the certificate because they got paid for it to, you know, paid for it to get studied. You know, so go to the school, you get paid for it rather than paying because the institute's going to make money. So they just pass on some money. And we have seen this happening. So yes, you're right. At some certain percentage of the money gets wasted as well. And there's lots of money that you're investing in training. So my probably view is that you have to find a balance. You have to find a balance of continue to train because you can't just keep relying forever on migration, right? So you have to build an infrastructure to ensure that you have a training facilities. You have a processes for a training and everything. That's for a long-term solution. And on a short-term solution, you might want to use a migration so that you can fulfill your skill shortages for a short term. And for a long term, you have another strategy in place where you're training people to become skilled in that particular area. So I see it that way that, you know, it should be a balance of both rather than just training or rather than just migration.
Yeah. Totally get it. Training, and I'm not saying for a moment that training isn't important. It is important. But when you have a shortage that is hurting your economy, if you were a top business and you had a shortage that was hurting your profitability, you would think of a training program, but that wouldn't be the first thing you do. You know, the first thing you do would be to fill that shortage quickly. The training program, absolutely vital, absolutely not negotiable. That's what I want to make clear, that I'm not against training because I think it's incredibly important. And it's incredibly important to create a continuum of skills, and training enriches the whole system, but it's not the solution for a short-term crunch in a skills shortage. The short-term fix is to bring people in quickly. And I think we're not doing that enough. We haven't done that enough. And we're training, I guess, we're using people, the construction industry is using people who are not, haven't got that depth of training and experience. They're trying to get their accreditation and training quickly. And so we are relying on, particularly when you get, you know, like the top tier companies have select the best people. And then when you get smaller companies, you still great people, but there's also people who do lack that sort of deep experience. And particularly when, you know, as in any trade, as in if you're a pilot flying a plane or whatever it is, if everything's going well and it's simple, it's an easy job. But where you're really worth your while is to predict when things are going to go wrong and fix things before they go wrong. And I mean, we saw, you know, it was ironic that I've seen this incredible shortage of bricklayers, particularly. Shortage of bricklayers. And then I saw on the news a brick wall that collapsed, right? I don't know if you remember, there was a house in somewhere in the southwest of Sydney, and the wall of it fell over and it sort of slumped. And I don't know if you remember it. It was all over the news. Of course, the building commissioner went charging in to disrupt the builder and close them down. But what I could see clearly in the photo, and I had an engineer, on this podcast, and we talked about this particular issue, and we could both see that there were no ties in the brick wall that would stabilize the wall and tie it to the rest of the building. And I'm like, that's because they couldn't get a bricklayer and they were on a fixed contract, probably. This is hypothetical. I haven't looked into the real story. And then, you know, they just did what they could. And it's easy to say, oh, shoddy workmanship, dodgy builder, easy to say. But I think you can see in that photo of that collapsed wall, skill shortage. An experienced bricklayer would never have laid that wall without wall ties. It just wouldn't have happened. They would have put wall ties in that wall because that's where you can't, because every experienced bricklayer knows that you can't build a wall if you don't tie it in. And an experienced bricklayer, if asked to build a wall but not supplied with wall ties, would just stop, right? So, sorry, it's not going to happen. But so we always try and have three key takeaways from today's episode. I guess I'll start by suggesting we need to do something different. Well, maybe that's an opinion. Anyway, that can be an opinion. Point, talking point, opinion. I think we need to do something a bit different. We can't rely on training our way out of a crisis in skills. Like, I think we need to supercharge the pipeline. We need to train people in English. We need to bring people here that are truly skilled, demonstrably skilled in their trade, and bring them here and just give them English lessons. There's so much better value, I think, than the billions we spend on training people who don't even want to do a trade. And I remember, I think one more anecdote is there's a program in my son's school. My son's going into year 11. There's a program where you can do an apprenticeship at the same time as you're in year 11 and 12. And we were sort of finding out a little bit about it and asking about it. And I don't know how many people in the class, but it's a big school. It's a senior campus out of two schools. And maybe there's 300 kids in year 11 and 12, and maybe another 300 in year 12. Round numbers. I don't know the stats. And I said, out of interest, how many people are in this program doing the apprenticeship through year 11 and 12, and there was one. Like, that's it. One person out of 300 that was actually doing an apprenticeship. And like, rightly, my son, like most kids, he wants to go to uni. You know, he's aspiring to, you know, he thought about a trade. He did a bit of work experience. He wants to be qualified. He wants to go to uni. So that, like, I just feel like we're creating elaborate training programs for people who don't want to do them. And we're trying to incentivize, but really you can incentivize all you want.
Yeah. So I think three takeaways from my end would be, first is as in business under in the construction industry would be first to understand the migration programs and get a right guidance on how to utilize this migration program to fulfill skill shortages that your business are facing. That would be the second one. And third would be finding ways to recruit from the global market. You know, so let's say in your case, you had someone who could go back home and then find people for you, but not every business would have that. So I think finding the right pathways to recruit from the global market would be the third takeaway that I would suggest for businesses who would probably want to utilize migration pathways to fulfill their skill shortages.
I'll ask you one more quick question, bit of a lightning round question. Do you think we're missing out on people who then go to other countries like Saudi Arabia or the Middle East, generally Singapore? Are we're missing out on those tradespeople? Because I don't think the UAE or Saudi really worry about whether you've got English or not.
Yeah, they don't really have English language requirements.
Yeah, no one checks that you can speak Arabic, I guess.
So it's more about I think in those countries, yes, your question is quite right, and it's a really good question. You know? that, yes, we are losing out not only to Middle Eastern countries like Saudi or, Dubai. Obviously, they don't really have any much of a criteria where you have to have English, you have to have certain skills. You know, they have a very limited criteria and they're very easy. But obviously, at the same time, they don't really have a permanent migration pathways. So it's both ways, but we are losing out. Yes, to answer your question, yes, we are losing out to those countries. We're losing out to other countries like Canada as well, where migration policies are much, comparatively to Australia, it's a bit easier to migrate. And the number of migration Canada takes a year is 421,000 against Australia's 160,000 a year. So it's almost three times higher than what we take in Australia.
Yeah. So I think we do need a different approach where we even bring people with very limited English, but we then like supercharge their English learning, and we really like, we, you know, because that's probably the answer. Like even people with, and realistically, if you live here, you'll pick up English, right? If you, you know, I think so. It's a little bit like people used to come to this country. I mean, I read a statistic that 65% of labor in the Snowy River, the Snowy Hydro Scheme, that was 50s, 60s era, 65% were foreign workers, were immigrants. That would never have been built without that injection of labor. And that injection of labor would probably never have happened if they had an English test applied to those people. But so Weber, thank you so much. Guest today, Weber Patel from Aussies Group, and we'll put a link, and I can certainly attest to the fact that your business has been exceptional in helping us bring sponsor people, essentially. And we're very grateful. And so thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Matt. Thank you for inviting me to this podcast. It's been really great conversation.
Thanks, Weber. Thanks also to our listeners. To access exclusive content, we invite you to join our community by subscribing to our mailing list. The link can be found in the show notes. And we'll also make sure we have a link to Weibao's company, Aussies. So for anyone who would be interested or get in touch with us, we'll definitely put you in touch. Thank you, Weibao. Have a great day.
You too, thank you.
You've been listening to Buildapedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildapedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.